Steven?
Yeah. My grandkids call me Stevie D.
Stevie D.
Yeah.
Get groovy.
Yeah. When I was a little kid on M.O. King, Big Nine, they called me Papa. Yeah. Papa's got a brand new bag.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I got down to Miami, they called me Gringo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's Big Nine look like now?
It's been redistricted. The Bessie Smith Strut Hall is down there. African American Museum is there. They still have some nightclubs, but they're more white. It's real close to University of Tennessee at Chattanooga campus, mm-hmm. and the college kids bled over
right.
to ML King.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and so... You know, you can see a good mix of white and black people on right. ML King. Whereas when I went down there, I was the only white boy on the street.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty wild that you were this little kid going around to these different black bars and nightclubs and distributing that way. It's but that was your market. Like
yeah.
you found a market.
Yeah.
It's crazy how like back then you had to, when you were young, you didn't have any connections. You just had to like, your market was what was around you.
Yeah.
Like
because of transportation, you're a little kid, bicycle, yeah. where are you going
right.
to go?
Exactly. You're one of the things that struck me about this book was like your relationship with cocaine got pretty intense for a while.
Yeah.
What were those party days in Miami? Talk about the party days.
Oh man, the party days. Oh, huh. We would go to clubs. We did, you know, coke quite a bit, and you know, the girls all, you know, we'd give them a vial of coke and they'd go to the bathroom and they'd come back empty. You know, there'd be yeah. eight girls in the bathroom all yeah. snorting a mm-hmm. gram, you know.
Yeah.
So you had to have multiples, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was rampant. Like it was, normal everyday people were using it.
Yeah. Look, I'll tell you what we'd do. In Atlanta, we'd go to like the Limelight Club and do a bunch of cocaine. And it'd be 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning. This would be like on a Thursday, all right? We'd get these girls so jacked up, all right? We'd put them in the car, drive them up to Lake Lanier, and the next thing you know, we'd be out on a boat at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning just partying like crazy, mm-hmm. you know? They'd spend the night on the boat.
Just go, go, go.
Go, go, go.
When you were in Miami, yeah, it seems like that's when you would the all weekend you were up and yeah. you kind of it got really dark
yeah.
and depressed for a minute. Do you think that brought you into like depression and a dark time, or do you just think it was something that you grew out of, or did you have to like what were the drawbacks to doing so much coke?
The drawbacks were it messed with your system as far as weight and mm-hmm. how you felt. I never felt, after I did coke for a couple of days, I'd get off of it for a week and just smoke weed. I just never felt, weed was my go-to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes me feel good. Coke makes you feel good, but a friend of mine from Miami said, you know, you start out dancing with a lady and end up wrestling with a bitch.
Right.
That's cocaine.
Yeah.
The first two or three times you do cocaine, you think, my God, this is great.
Doesn't get any better than this.
It don't get no better than this, you know? It's like, you know, flying to Paris for breakfast.
You know? It's a beautiful way to put it. Yeah,
really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
and by the end, you're smoking crack.
And what happened is all my good weed people that I put cocaine on,
yeah,
it messed their lives up, and the people just get so addicted, and then they get strung out, and then they start doing stupid stuff, mm-hmm. you know. So,
but it really helped in your development. It was necessary income for you at a certain point while
right.
you were building up the indica farm,
right?
Because there was a lot of things that went into it, and a lot of money that you had to sink into it. It took 7 years.
Yeah, you had to feed, you know, 50 people.
Yeah,
think about feeding 50 people three times a day.
Yeah. Yeah, even in Jamaica, it adds up.
Yeah.
So that's the seed money literally came from profits that you were stashing from coke that you were selling.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. did any of your old distributors, you know, the guys that were that were moving product all over the country for you, do you know what happened to them? Did they end up getting busted? Would they fall off? Like if you were running loads from San Antonio, would guys just disappear without a trace? Or would you know if something happened to them?
They would call and say, I'm real sick.
And what did that mean? They got arrested?
I'm so sick, you don't need to come see me.
Wow.
I'm not in good health.
Weren't you worried that one of them was going to turn around and rat on you?
Well, maybe.
That's just
maybe.
It's a chance you take, right?
That's a chance to take.
Chance you take.
You know, do you want to lose your connection?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
How did you protect yourself from setups? Like in terms of, you know, a guy getting busted with 100 pounds, he turns around and he fingers you to the cops.
Yeah.
How did you try? Did you insulated yourself on the buy side by using point people between you and your supplier?
Right.
But did you have a buffer between you and your distributors, your customers?
No, not really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Once we started, got away from coke and started doing pot. They were family people. They were all reliable.
Right.
You know, they worked it like a job, 8 to 5, you know,
right.
And it didn't whack them out. You know, if you've ever done coke for a long period of time, it changes you. You know, it changes everything about you.
Mm.
You know, it makes you into a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually not a good person.
Right. Not an honest person.
Right.
So your distributors would have your pot. Distributors would have honest jobs too.
Yeah.
But on the side, move hundreds of pounds.
Yeah.
Wow.
That way everything could,
you got a paper trail.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Where were some of these guys? Like, where was your pot being moved to? What states? What were some of your best markets?
Maryland, Washington, D.C. area, Nashville, Cincinnati, Atlanta. Those were our best.
Could you get bigger prices for different markets, or was the price always about 900?
We were buying it for $6 and selling it for $9.
Yeah.
My doing something stupid.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was paying 900 and got busted.
Right. Right. Know, yeah.
For, you know, the drought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the drought season. That's like, it's not even a thing anymore. There's so much pot.
There's no drought.
Yeah.
You get pot year round.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. I remember, because I'm from the West Coast. So the drought season was the end of summer, like, middle of August. No, not for us. Because the harvest in Oregon and California, harvest season is beginning of October.
Yeah.
So, all of those thousands of plants and those thousands of outdoor pounds, it takes about 9 or 10 months after harvest to get all sold out, right?
Well, in the day, it only took to May.
Right, exactly. There was a lot more pot when I was running.
Yeah.
So, it would – usually you had about a month, maybe a month and a half at worst, where, the only pot that was available was either Mexican brick dirt, which is stuff you used to push, in my era, you couldn't even move,
right?
Or the super expensive indoor pot, hydroponic, that was before $1,000 a pound, and then you could only get like 5 of them.
Right.
So, those were tough days, man.
Yeah. My drought would be like a 4-month drought.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's a whole vacation. That's, that's
you
brutal.
You just took off. At first, when I wasn't making so much money, this is going to sound funny, I liked the drought because I was off for 4 months.
Right.
I didn't have to drive. I didn't have to fuck with people.
Yeah.
I was off for 4 months. But as I started making more money, the drought started hurting. Because guess what? The more money you make, the more you spend.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then when the drought hit, I go, oh, man.
You got to rein in expenses,
right?
Because you're missing out on millions of dollars a month.
Yeah, at least 200,000 or 300,000.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were your expenses as the money kept going up?
Okay, expenses were cars, motel rooms, vacations. Mm-hmm. I took some great vacations.
I bet you did.
And I would, you know, I take people with me on my vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I take my own party.
Where'd you go?
We'd go to Jamaica, Mexico, Cancun was a good place we'd go.
Yeah. Doing coke, doing
yeah,
a little
doing
blow.
Coke, yeah.
Did you ever think about making better connections in source countries like Mexico, like you did in Jamaica, but with growers,
yeah,
and trying to get your price down?
After Jamaica, I didn't want to, I didn't want to get back into the from the seed to the plant.
Right.
You know, all I wanted to do is get the best, like you, the very best weed I could get at the very best price and move it. I didn't want to have to move it across the border.
Yeah.
That's why I never went to Mexico. We always got our stuff after it was across the border.
Right. Was there ever a problem? Did loads ever get intercepted at the border? Like, would you go down to Houston and then discover that there was nothing to
pick
up?
They wouldn't call me till it was on site.
I got you. Okay.
Because once it was on site, I dropped straight there.
Yeah.
You know.
Because it's going to be gone in a day.
Yeah. I went one time. I went on vacation. Okay, to La Jolla, California. Do you know where La Jolla is?
Oh, of course. It's nice. I love La Jolla.
Oh, yeah. So I got there, and I'll go down to the bar, you know, and I'm drinking a drink, sitting at the – I stayed 6 weeks at the Hilton.
Wow.
In La Jolla. I got a room rate of $100 a night.
Nice. You got a deal? You got like a...
I said, I'm going to be here a long, long time. Mm-hmm. I was paying in cash.
Yeah.
$100 a night. I stayed there 6 weeks. And like on vacation, mm-hmm. I would go up and down the coast of California, act like a tourist.
Yeah.
I had 90 grand in my Mercedes.
Yeah.
And I was just driving around mm-hmm. the coast, having a good time. And so I was sitting in the bar. I didn't have no weed. I had nothing to smoke.
Mm.
So I'm sitting at this bar in La Jolla at the Hilton, and there's this guy sitting next to me, and he had like a service uniform on with his name right mm-hmm. there. And I said, man, I'm from Georgia, and I'm already out here in California, and I haven't got any weed to smoke. And he goes, well, I'll get you some weed. You know, I said, I just like, you know, how much you talking about? He said, I said, I'm just talking about, I'm desperate, you know, an ounce I'll mm-hmm. be happy with. Well, come over to my house and I'll get you an ounce of pot. I just met this guy.
Yeah.
So I get my Mercedes and I follow him. He goes and gets in a utility van
mm-hmm.
and drives to a house in the subdivision. And I'm on vacation. All I'm doing is looking for a bag of pot. So I get to his house and he has a carpet cleaning business, and he went across the border there 3 or 4 times a day.
Right. Back to Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah. And he did jobs.
Yeah.
All right. So he was buying, you know, a little at a time, you know, bringing it back, you know. And I said, look, I got 90 grand, you know. I said, how much pot can you get across the border every time you go? He said, I've got 2 big plastic tubs in there. One he had water in with mm-hmm. soap, and the other one was cut in half and had a fake bottom in it.
Yeah.
So he decided that he'd go bring me back 20 pounds a day. All right. And so once he got up to 100, I came over there, picked him up, bought him,
and
went
brought,
home.
Brought him back across the country to Georgia.
Yeah.
Wow. How much? And you
same? I bought him dirt cheap, 500 pound, ended up selling him for 1,000. I made 50,000 on vacation.
Wow.
Not even wanting to do a deal.
Yeah.
Just fell into one.
Don't you think when you reach that level of the drug game, it just comes, things like that just come to you.
Yeah,
it's like magic.
Please run my, here, I'm bringing a load up. I want you to be the exclusive distributor.
Yeah.
You know, you're the only one I trust.
Right. So you get suppliers from Mexico or the southern border to hit you up and say, hey, I need you to move 100 pounds of this. Wow.
Or more like 1,000.
1,000 pounds, whatever it is. Yeah. Did you find weed was better coming from the West Coast? Or was there no difference? It was from Mexico.
Until 2010 or 2011, I'd never smoked any medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
The closest I came was the indica. You know, it was about 20%, and the stuff they were growing was about 20.
Yeah. Do you have people that hit you up now or in the recent years, old suppliers trying to get you back in the game?
No, not any big time. I've got guys that are friggin' 70 years old, you know, that say, hey, man, can you get me a bag, you know?
It's tough. Yeah. It's pretty wild. Have you ever seen that movie, The Mule, with Clint Eastwood?
Oh, yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
I really did.
I think being a senior citizen is probably the best way to be a drug smuggler.
Yeah. These days, I guess.
Who's going to pull you over? Who's going to suspect anything? And if you do get caught, how much time are they going to give you?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if you got a real prick of a judge, she might give you life.
6 months.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Is it hard to stay away?
I smoke pot. I love it.
Is it hard for you? But was it hard for you to stay away from the game when you had to go straight? What do you miss the most about it? Or what did you miss the most about it?
Jumping in that car, driving to a location with a bunch of friggin' money,
mm-hmm.
doing the deal, getting the best weed, mm-hmm. putting it in my car and driving it back.
Yeah.
That was a thrill.
What were your goals as like a teenager? Did you have any long-term goals before you became a kingpin?
No, I wanted to go to the University of Georgia and live a great life and not work a day.
Yeah.
I wanted to have, I lived in a mansion when I was going to college.
Yeah.
I mean, what can you say?
Yeah. Yeah.
It had a swimming pool in the backyard and 5 girls and 2 guys living there, and they were all freaky.
Yeah. So you're very much driven by pleasure.
Yeah.
Life is, if you've derived meaning or happiness, I guess, from feeling, from...
I wanted my hours to be my own hours.
Yeah.
And if you're working for somebody else, you're a slave to them, man. The job. Yeah. Working at Thunder Creek Harley-Davidson, I had never worked retail in my whole entire life. I hated it.
Yeah.
That's why I wrote the book. I thought, maybe if I write a book and make $1 million this way, I'll get to keep the money and stay out of jail and still be a kingpin.
Yeah. Yeah.
But my book will be my weed.
Right.
You can buy my book on Amazon for the same amount as a 3-finger lid. And it will give you hours and hours of pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely.
For less than a $15 bag of pot, you can buy my book.
Yeah, that's right. A 3-finger lid, man.
Yeah. Now, the people that I've given my book to, they said, the first time I read your book was because it was just you. The second time I read your book, it was for pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll tell you what I'll do on this show. I'll give a money back guarantee.
Oh, crazy.
Did you hear that?
Yeah, your wife didn't like it.
Yeah.
She wasn't happy about that.
If you buy my book and you're unhappy, you just, email me and I'll send your money back.
Wow, look at that. Steve, you're putting your stamp on it.
Yeah, I gave money back guarantee on every weed I sold.
Did you ever have people that would return weed? I've had to do that. I've had to go back to people.
Once or twice.
I've had to go back to, some of my suppliers and be like, hey, man, I can't move this. I got home. I went through it. It's got too many seeds and stems.
I'll pull back some.
Yeah.
I bought, during the drought, the first person to make it back with weed after the drought is the one that gets all that first money.
Right.
Okay. So I took a pound of seeds out to, I had a friend, and back in the 80s, USA Today would post the DEA bust, everybody that got busted and what they confiscated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A buddy of mine read this, and there was a farm that they had confiscated in Kansas. So him and his old lady go to this confiscated farm, all right, where there was weed being grown the year before. I took a pound of seeds out there to them. There was crime tape mm-hmm. around the house and around the barn. He took the crime tape down, hooked him up a generator, got electricity to the house. There was a well there anyway. Got the water, went out to the barn, tore the crime scene tape off the barn, cranked up the tractors, and planted a pound of seeds.
Holy shit.
So I bought it. What I did was...
Oh, so you bought that confiscated land?
No, no. When he finished, I went out there to him. He was growing on, he was growing illegal weed on government confiscated land.
Wow.
He had medical problems.
Right.
And he had rheumatoid arthritis and he needed a heart. And when the helicopters would fly over, he'd wave to them. Okay. Wow. He said, I'm either going to make $1 million or the government's going to get me new health. Mm. I'm going to federal prison for medical reasons.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, bless his heart, the pot he grew was so pretty and so nice. And the buds were just luscious. And you could roll a joint. And right towards the end, you say, I think I'm getting high. Let's roll one more. You roll that joint. You almost get high.
Yeah.
I bought 40 pounds for him for $9,000, $225 a pound, and I fucking burned it.
Oh, no.
Burned 40 pounds of weed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's people that would try to grow pot, like, in their backyards. It could look really nice, but, man, there's a lot that goes into it to actually get the THC that gets you stoned.
Yeah.
And it's, I remember having like gigantic freezer bags full of literally leaves that kind of smelled like pot. And we put them in big ass blunts. And just, I mean, nothing. We might as well have been smoking a paper.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, that did happen. The Mexicans. So, but when you were growing, like, how did you know when you planted your farm in Jamaica? How did you know how to do it? How did you know how to grow the female plant to cross-pollinate? Who was in charge of all that?
Ronnie and David Harper.
Right. How did they know how to grow?
They've been growing pot all their lives.
Right. And those are guys that you grew up with.
Yeah.
In Georgia.
Yeah. Ronnie did an indoor grow for me when you're using indica pot seeds.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. But you didn't know. You basically just masterminded and bankrolled it. You didn't. Yeah. The expertise was on them.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And whatever happened to them?
Ronnie got in, got out clean. Nothing. David... he got out clean, messed around, and got caught with 500 kilos, 1,100 pounds, and did 14 years in the prison and about 5 or 6 years out on probation. He just recently got off paper, and I've talked to him.
Wow. Know. That's a long time for weed.
Yeah.
Wow.
But that was like his third major conviction.
Oh, I see. So he had really high points.
Oh, high points.
Yeah.
I had no points.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. You had a really stellar background, but the first time you got caught.
Yeah.
Like you didn't get arrested. You started selling weed at age 13. You didn't get arrested for the first time until you were
39 years old.
Wow. That's
39.
That's an incredible run.
Yeah.
That's an incredible run. I mean, you're so lucky and fortunate and smart too, though. You covered your ass. Was there, did you feel like, bringing it across borders, did you feel law enforcement getting more tough as the years went on?
Yeah, I didn't want to do the border crossing.
Yeah.
You know, it had to be on the American side.
Yeah.
We did, the Jamaican thing taught me about, transportation, mm-hmm. Leave that to somebody else.
Did you guys really get in a shootout in Jamaica?
Yeah. That was a buddy of mine, David, when they kidnapped his daughter, Andy.
Okay, so let's back up for a sec. David was one of the masterminds.
Yeah, he was a point man in Jamaica.
Yeah, and he helped you grow and supervise the harvest and the growing.
He was like the main guy in Jamaica.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. The main guy.
And so there is this rude boy gangster from Kingston.
Yeah.
Who, how did he get wind about the pot farm? How do you find out about it?
What happened was he was from the neighborhood there in Jamaica. And his cousin got him to go to Kingston. You know, a country bumpkin goes to Kingston with the city boys. And they introduce him to cocaine. And they buy him clothes and they get him all fixed up and everything. And in Kingston, he gets involved in a shootout where everybody is killed. Except him.
Right.
And he walks out of there with AK-47, a kilo of cocaine, and the keys to a brand new BMW, and drives that son of a bitch out to the jungle.
Right, right. And he goes,
he started going through his cocaine, you know, all fucked up and everything, and then he knows that we're going pot there, and so he came to rob us. But there wasn't any money there. All it was weed.
Right.
So he took the kid.
Right. David's
daughter.
Daughter.
Yeah.
Who he fathered with his Jamaican wife.
Right.
Wow. And so he kidnaps, and she was how old?
She was like 3 years old.
Oh, my God.
Kidnapped this little girl, took her up into the jungle, and David went back up there, and, you know, him and Ronnie and Kit's brother and a couple of farmers went with us, and we cornered this guy, and his name was Bad Dog. And David shot him in the knee, and he dropped Andy, and we caught him in the campfire late at night.
Right. And then the locals, the Jamaicans, started beating his ass?
Yeah, they just beat him, broke his gun.
Wow.
Because
did they kill him?
No, they just beat him senseless. Jamaica, it was death penalty for possession of a bullet, let alone a gun.
Wow.
If you had a bullet, they could put you to death.
Right. Yeah. But it's also such a lawless place. So, but here's the thing. Knowing that having a bullet could be the death penalty, weren't you scared about growing a gigantic pot farm?
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's... to tell you the truth, that's how we got the land and the ability to get it so cheap, is because the Rastafarian, you know, leader there and the police, they fucking thought we were a joke, that nothing would ever become of it. So, you know, sure, you can have this land. Sure, you can do that. You know, go ahead, try. They didn't think we were going to make it.
Right. They thought you were gonna get killed.
Or just give up or
right.
just, you know,
right.
run out of money or mm-hmm. just disappear.
Right. After you left the farm, did you sell the land?
No, it's still in Indy's name.
Still in little Indy's name. Now Indy is she grown? Is she living? What happened to her?
I saw Indy in 1999 and she was like 18 years old. And she and I split a gram of cocaine.
Great. Oh, good influence.
Yeah.
But you haven't been back to Jamaica?
No.
So
but
you,
David has.
Okay. Gotcha.
He's been, since he got out of jail and off paper, he's been back twice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't want, you know, for me to go back there, I haven't really got anything to go back to. He does.
I figure just for nostalgia reasons, right?
Yeah.
But
we talked about going on vacation back there.
I wonder, and you said after that, because, you know, you were employing all of these farmers that really needed the work.
But they kept it up. They kept growing. But the thing about it is, if you don't have transportation, you don't have shit.
Right.
Okay. A bag of pot that we could sell in the United States for $300, if you don't have transportation, if you're trying to sell this to a smuggler on the dock, you're going to get $30.
Right.
You ain't going to get $300 an ounce. You get $30 an ounce.
Right. You're talking about a smuggler. When you say a smuggler on the dock, what do you mean?
What he does is a smuggler has a boat, and what he does is he comes down there and either gets one third of the crop for smuggling or just buys a crop and smuggles it on his own.
Where is he smuggling it to?
America.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's, yeah, of course. So it's not worth it for him. Why is he going to pay anything but the
going
lowest
right,
price? Yeah,
right.
The lowest price.
So
right.
Instead of them making $36,000 a year, they were making 12.
Right. Which, you know,
for 12, the same effort.
Right. Right. How many guys at that time were like that? Smugglers, you know, American guys were coming through Jamaica.
Man, they were everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere. They said in Miami, a millionaire is made every day.
From Jamaican pot.
Or smuggling.
Smuggling.
Period. Yeah.
Wow.
A millionaire is made every day in Miami.
And that was the main route from that area?
Up to Miami.
Through Miami?
Yeah.
How long is the journey on like the boat that you took, right? Like a big fishing vessel. How long does that take you to get from Jamaica to Miami?
It's 500 nautical miles. And we'd go about, I don't know, 20 or 30 knots an hour.
Uh-huh. So,
you know, 2 days.
2 days. It's nothing.
Yeah.
That's nothing. Wow.
But 2 days, you know, you're spending out in the boat in the middle of fucking ocean, you know?
Hey, yeah.
You know, it's not like a cakewalk.
Sure. Yeah. I guess not. I mean, yeah, I guess like you're ready to get off of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Coast Guard. Yeah. You know, all kinds of shit happens.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Did you ever get offered from smugglers to try to buy your loads?
No. Yeah. We once we got
you're not selling it.
We got distribution.
Yeah, we're seller. You controlled the supply chain from manufacturing.
We control from the dirt and the seed all the way to the last joint.
Yeah. Yeah.
The whole distribution cycle, we controlled it all.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why you maximize your profit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you made, was that your most profitable era? I guess so. Could you make more just running pot from Mexico than one load of indica from Jamaica?
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is that 1,800 pounds of weed that would get out of Jamaica like once or twice a year, and they bring it, you know, and I'd get it to distribute. That was just like part of maybe 8,000 pounds I'd sell out of the year.
Right. So you were still, even
you see, while
even with
were,
the indica loads, you would still move
in. Oh, yeah. People would call me and say, hey, I've got a load. Can you sell it for me?
Wow.
I was the guy that people brought their loads to.
Right.
If they wanted to get paid.
Right. Right. And why is that? Because you just had all the customers?
I had the distribution, and my money was always right.
Right. You're reliable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing short.
Yeah.
Nothing short.
What was the key, a couple of keys to your success?
Communication. You can do nothing without communication.
Explain that.
Setting up that 800 number was the key to our business.
Right.
If you're in a different hotel every night, you don't know who's trying to get in touch with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You don't know who you should be calling.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't sit down and call everybody and say, do you need me? You would let them call you. Mm-hmm. So the 800 number was the key, and that 800 number was good for, I don't know, 12 years.
Wow. 12 years and tens of thousands of pounds, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, your suppliers missed you after you got out of the game.
Yeah.
Wow. Incredible. Well, what have you learned? What are your biggest regrets from your time as a smuggler and a distributor?
I don't have any regrets. You know, the only thing that I regret is the 5 or 6 years in the coke business. You know, messing up a lot of good weed people.
Right, by giving them coke to sell and them doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
People lost everything.
Yeah. they, like I say, you could take 100 pounds and leave it with a guy, and a month later, come back and pick up 120 gram, huh?
Mm-hmm.
What if he smoked an ounce a week? No big deal. Mm-hmm. You drop off a kilo, 36 ounces in a kilo, shy of 8 grams. You add 8 grams to a key, and you got 36 even ounces,
mm-hmm.
huh? They would take that and divide it up into ounces and quarter ounces, everything, start selling it, and they'd start doing it. And hell, they'd end up doing as much as they sold.
Yeah.
And you come to collect,
mm-hmm.
and they go, oh, man, this one right here, I didn't make any money. And I said, you were supposed to make $36,000. Why didn't you make any money? Well, a couple of guys, you know, I fronted an ounce to, and they got fucked up and wouldn't pay me, and blah, 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 and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah.
Pissed it up their nose.
And I ruined a bunch of people that I wish I'd never ruined,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the keys to success as a Coke dealer, we've talked about this on the show, one of my keys to the real only key to success in that business is to not do your product. If you could stay away from your product, you're going to make some money.
Yeah. When you let that genie out,
yeah.
of the bottle, it is so hard. I look, like, every now and then I want to take a vacation. All right. So I had a kilo of Coke, and I just wanted 3 or 4 days, you know, just to go out and drink and have a date and go out and eat meals and, you know. And so I let a guy hold a kilo, and I gave it to him on Friday afternoon. And I was supposed to pick it up Monday afternoon.
Mm.
And he was standing at his mother's house. And I thought, surely to God, he can stay at his mother's house and just have the kilo and give it back to me on Monday. I was going to pay him like $1,000 a day just to hold it. Just to hold it. Well, about that 9 o'clock that night, he said, you know, I got to worrying about you, you know, and, you know, cocaine. And I know how to test it to see how pure it is. And so I made just a little incision into that cocaine football that you handed me.
Hmm.
And I got just a little cocaine out. And I did my test to see the purity of it. And it came back about 93 or 94% pure. And I hadn't done any that pure in a while, so I just did a little bit. And then I did a little bit more. And then I started running that teaspoon just straight into the and coming back out.
This is what happens when a fat girl has one bite of chocolate ice cream.
Okay. And then he left his mother's house about midnight. She told me he left at midnight Friday night in a hurry to go somewhere. Took some luggage with him. I thought, oh, shit. Fucking found him at the Ramada Inn. He'd been laying up there for 3 or 4 days. He had smoked 4 ounces of cocaine.
To himself.
By himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And guess what? When I got him back, guess what he told me? It's your fault. You know I was weak. You shouldn't have left it with me. I said, yeah, you taught me a lesson. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, that was it.
So, Steve, what is it about you that kept you from going over the edge? Because you, if not, maybe you weren't fully addicted, but you had a really bad habit. You were doing it a lot.
I have I don't have an addictive quality.
But what was it about you that allowed you to go from just having a bad habit to a full-blown addiction that ruined you? What do you think? Was it the fact that you had this incredibly lucrative business that was more important?
Yeah, and when you're getting it so cheap, you know, my last keys I was getting for $9,000 a key.
And flipping it for how much?
Shit, 36.
Holy shit. That's just from passing it off.
Yeah.
And you do that twice a month.
Yeah.
That's the best business. So you gave it up to do all this complicated marijuana farming in Jamaica? Why? Is it because you had a moral problem with?
Yeah.
Wow.
I just get, you know, I was ruining people with cocaine, and we decided to get back in the marijuana business. And if we were going to do that, we were going to control it from the seed in the ground to the transportation to the distribution. Mm-hmm. And we did it.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Go read about it, folks. Indica, available on Amazon, Patreon. These are my closest, my best fans, the inner circle of the podcast.
What's the name of this group?
Patreon.
Patreon. Money back guarantee on this book.
Boom. Tell them your your wife is just over there shaking with fury. Tell them your email. So if they don't like the book, they can email
you. I'll tell you what you can do.
They're going to like the book. I promise you. It's only 200 pages or so. It was great.
My email address. You can email me at my book. Let's see. IndicaTheBook.com, and there's a place there for comments. Mm. So if you don't like the book, you leave your name and address, and I'll mail you some cash.
There you go. But you're going to love the book. I promise. It was, I get sent a lot of books from people that have written them and that want to come on the show and tell their story. And I don't find most of them very compelling just because, you know, a lot of people, you know, many stories have been told, everything's been done, but I cracked your book. I read a couple of pages and I read a couple of more, and man, it really like hooked me, and I read it in like a day and a half, and I called you. Did I not? Yeah. Did I not call you and say, okay, let's do it. Let's have you on the pod.
First sentence of the book, first little paragraph. The first joint I ever saw in my whole life, I rolled. I was the summer of 1964. In a month and a half, I would be 13 years old and starting the eighth grade. The country was in a grip of the British invasion.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
The Beatles.
And it was a cool
look. Rolling Stones.
And it was a cool look into history, like American, you know, contemporary American history. It was really fascinating and really fun and really entertaining. So Steve, thank you once again. Thank you so much, Patreon. We'll see you next week. And Steve, we will, hang out again soon, brother. Roll one up.
All right.
Smoke one for the homies. Peace out.
Bye.